Welcome to Vicom's weekly podcast. I'm Vicom CEO James Serene. I'm delighted to have with us on the line, actually from Washington, D.C., our senior fellow Brigadier General Michael Herzog. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi. Very well. Thank you.
If I can, and you're sort of perfectly placed in Washington to hopefully comment on this as well, I want to start off really just trying to understand what we think is going to happen next with the Iran nuclear deal, and what is the intent of Iran behind this letter that they've sent? They're sort of, it's almost like a threat, isn't it? Like in 60 days they're going to do even more things, and they're kind of calling on the Europeans to sort of do their bit, and it's pretty frightening, isn't it, really? I mean, they're talking about uranium enrichment, heavy water. I mean, could you unpick some of that for us?
Well, the Iranians announced and sent letters to the effect that they will stop exporting excess material of enriched uranium and heavy water. They were allowed under the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, to do so. But very recently, the U.S. administration lifted the exemption on these activities as pertains to sanctions, so the Iranians are not allowed to export them, and they said they will not export them. But this means that if they continue enriching in Iran or accumulating heavy water, they will be in violation of the agreement, because the agreement sets a limit on the amount that they could hold. And they also said that if within 60 days sanctions are not lifted on their banks and energy and energy market, then they will take further steps in enriching uranium, implying that they might enrich more or possibly even to higher levels, because currently under the deal, they are allowed to enrich to a low level of 3.67%, and they imply that they will go beyond that. Now, we understand the immediate context of U.S. sanctions and Iranian response. Iran, I think, does not want to exit the deal for now. There stands much to lose. It doesn't want to lose the Europeans. So it's still playing a game of brinkmanship, kind of stepping on the line, but not overly crossing it. And I think mostly it's an appeal to the Europeans to do more in terms of facilitating trade with Iran, because the tool that the Europeans built, so-called INSTEX, is not effective enough. It applies only to humanitarian assistance, medical supplies, and so on, but not beyond that, and the Iranians would like to expand that. I think the Iranians are under very heavy U.S. pressure to get as much as they can, hoping that there will be a democratic president following the next elections, and he might navigate the United States back to the deal. Till then, they are unlikely to go back to the negotiating table, but may play more and more on the brink of violating the JCPOA. There is an article in JCPOA that says that if sanctions applied against Iran, not in the context of a so-called Iranian violation, and they are within their rights to not apply certain elements of the deal, part of the deal or all of the deal. And I suspect that this is the road that they are taking right now. There's obviously potential for escalation, but I think the Iranians chose very carefully the measures that they are taking so as not to give the Americans any employing the military option against them, but and to not drive away the Europeans, but rather get the Europeans to do more in favor of Iran.
But is there anything more that they can do? I mean, I think I've been following this whole establishment of INSTEX and things that they're trying to do in terms of trade, but is it you'll sense, you know, from being in Washington as well, that in many ways, you know, the US policy of increasingly tighter sanctions basically means that most companies face a choice. If they want to operate in the dollar system, or they want to trade with the US, they simply can't trade with Iran. So there's a limit to really how much trade can actually be done with Iran. And, you know, the European states can try and you know, do what they can, but ultimately the decisions will be made by, you know, companies around the world, and that will often be just not to trade with Iran. And that's the intent, isn't it, from the US administration?
That's correct, and that's what's happening. Companies make commercial calculations, not political ones, and they more and more decide to leave Iran. If they have to choose between the US market and the Iranian market, the choice is clear. And notwithstanding governmental policies and INSTEC and other tools, companies are leaving Iran or stopping trade with Iran. Mm. So there's not very much that the Europeans can do to save Iran from the pressure of economic sanctions or to cushion Iran. That's, I believe, in the margin. For now, it has provided the Iranians at least with an excuse of why they're not leaving the deal. Mm-hmm. But that excuse is coming under increasing pressure, which raises the question of whether the U.S. administration wants Iran to leave the deal or wants Iran to stay in the deal. And when you ask that question in Washington, D.C., you not get a clear answer.
I mean, and the other thing being that if they were to start increasing the enrichment of uranium and the percentage of enriched uranium, then that would also start to make people even more concerned that they were, you know, moving towards a proper restart of their nuclear program, and that could be a cause even more interventions, isn't that right?
Yes. If they resume enrichment and to higher levels beyond 3.67, they will shorten their breakout time, and that will raise concerns in the U.S. and possibly elsewhere. So we may see ourselves back to the tensions we experienced a few years back before the JCPOA. Again, I believe for now Iran would like to avert this kind of situation, so they are not wholly exiting the deal, only kind of stepping on the line.
Yeah, stepping on the line is a good way of describing it. If we could just pivot to talk a little bit about Gaza and what happened in Israel over the weekend, and I want to just ask a question which links to Iran, which is that from my understanding, a lot of what happened over the weekend was driven by the role of Palestinian Islamic Jihad working with Hamas, and that Palestinian Islamic Jihad is more influenced and has more of its funds and weapons from Iran, and that its leadership also, some are based in Damascus, and they seem to be closer to the Iranian personnel there. I wondered if you saw in what happened over the weekend a function of maybe some kind of Iranian role that also Iran wanted, and it was in their interest for there to be a big flare-up, and that was some way of Iran putting pressure on Israel. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Definitely, yes. This last round of hostilities was not initiated by Hamas. It was initiated by Islamic Jihad, an organization which is funded by Iran, close to Iran, and gets guidelines from Iran, and whose leadership is in Damascus and Beirut. They started this by sniper fire against Israeli soldiers during the weekly demonstrations along the border, and they injured two Israeli soldiers. Israel responded by firing at a Hamas military position and killing several people there. That was the immediate trigger, and I suspect that the Iranians, what they really want is to drag Israel into Gaza, into war in Gaza, possibly as part of their response to what Israel is doing in order to stop their entrenchment in Syria and Lebanon, their military entrenchment. So definitely, I think there was an Iranian hand here. Hamas joined for its own reasons, because it wanted to extricate more concessions from Israel in terms of allowing funds to go in, electricity, and other humanitarian and economic fixes. And they probably calculated that as Israel is going into Memorial Day, Independence Day, and then the Eurovision Song Contest next week, that this is a time to squeeze Israel. But as I said, they did not initiate this round. And my conclusion from this last round is perhaps Hamas is not wholly in control of matters in the Gaza Strip, because Islamic Jihad with Iranian funds, it seems to me, has managed to strengthen itself at the expense of Hamas. And they are they made statements during the this round, which I suspect were uncoordinated with Hamas, about how they are going to escalate things. So this is perhaps a new dimension of Jihad Islami with Iranian guidance trying to inflame the situation, and there may be a moment where even though Hamas would like to stop hostilities, they will be unable to do so. I think, looking ahead, that while it's true that both Israel and Hamas have no desire in a major confrontation, that's why the flare-ups, the recent ones we've had, were short ones, a few days, hundreds of rockets, Israel targeting Hamas and Jihad Islami and other military targets, and then a ceasefire. And that is because both parties do not want a major escalation where the IDF invades Gaza and takes over, as we've seen in the past. But I believe that given pressures in Israel, accumulating pressures following this round and the previous round, now 700 rockets, then 500 rockets, so that pressure may well lead our government in not too far future to escalate things far beyond a short round of hostilities, including possibly a ground operation in Gaza, because I think there's a limit to Israeli patience here. And while for good strategic reasons, our government did not want to go into Gaza because it was preoccupied with the North, it prioritized the Iranian threat in Syria and Lebanon, and Gaza itself is quite complicated, because once you conquer it, who exactly do you turn it over to? But my feeling is that next time we may experience, we may see or witness a much more serious escalation than these short rounds of violent eruption.
Well, it does seem, I mean, looking at it from just from the purely military perspective, it seems that Hamas and Islamic Jihad have got bolder in the last three phases. I mean, they're firing more missiles over a much shorter period of time. They also, I mean, I don't know if you agree with this, they also intentionally seem to be concentrating fire in very large numbers of missiles on smaller areas, and they've been very effective at that. So this time it was Ashkelon, where they were able to cause loss of life by, you know, concentrating a lot of missiles and maybe kind of overwhelming Iron Dome missile defense system, and also that this use of anti-tank missiles at civilian vehicles is unbelievable. I mean, from an observer, you know, looking at it here in London, it's absolutely unbelievable that they're using these, what are, I believe, quite long range but devastatingly effective anti-tank missiles at Israeli cars. I mean, so they really are getting bolder and upping sort of their sort of destructive intent. Would you agree?
Yes, in terms of their military tactics, first, you're right, they concentrated fire. They fired salvos with numerous rockets so as to overwhelm Iron Dome. The IDF publicly denies that Iron Dome was overwhelmed, because it can deal with numerous rockets, but possibly that is a challenge that is not easy for the IDF to cope if you're talking about dozens of rockets in one salvo. Secondly, they also used short-range rockets, but with much heavier payload. Hamas calls them Burkan. They are up to 10 kilometers, and but the payload is much heavier than the primitive Qassams. They fired anti-tank rocket missile at a civilian vehicle. It's not the first time in the past they fired at a school bus and hit it, but fortunately there were no school children there. And they calculated the way they escalate. For example, they did not fire Tel Aviv. They gradually escalated up to Beersheba and kept Tel Aviv for a higher grade of escalation, which didn't come. You could also see the IDF adjusting its tactics in this round. I think the emphasis was much heavier on what we call in military terms value targets, targets of value to Hamas, which were mostly headquarters located in high-rising buildings, and these were erased. In some cases, the residence of senior figures in Hamas Jihad Islami in Gaza, and resorting to targeted the interception of Hamas senior activists who used to provide Iranian funds for the Hamas war machine. This is something that Israel has not done for a long time in Gaza, and resulted to this in this round. So both sides have a learning curve, and they are adjusting. Naturally, obviously, the IDF is much stronger than Hamas. And if it decides to go to Gaza, it will conquer Gaza and destroy their war machine. But as I said, for strategic reasons, there's no appetite for that for now. But given the accumulated pressure, may well be that you will see the IDF in Gaza sooner rather than later.
It's interesting because I haven't heard you say that for a while. And you're being so certain about that. I mean, my question would be if the next time it's decided there will be some kind of ground operation, I mean, is the capability there, and is the sort of level of intelligence there to make sure that if there were to be a ground operation, which would surely come with you know, quite a high cost in terms of Israeli lives, and not at all straightforward, is there confidence that they would be able to actually reach, you know, the key sites that are actually driving Hamas, Islamic Jihad's ability to carry out these attacks? I mean, you know, do they know enough, and do they know exactly where to go? And is that quite, I mean, clearly it's a very difficult thing to do. This is urban warfare in a very densely populated area. There's a whole underground tunnel network where a lot of this stuff is stored. I mean, this is incredibly complicated, isn't it, from a planning perspective?
Yeah, but the answer is yes. I think the IDF is confident that it could go in, find the right places. They have very good intelligence. They know where to go and what to do. And they, for all of our enemies, Hamas is the weakest, ultimately. And the IDF definitely overwhelmed them. But yes, it's complicated tactically and strategically. Tactically, because they have a kind of an underground city of tunnels inside Gaza from where they will conduct the war. And that would pose a challenge to the IDF. And strategically, as I said earlier, if you go in, do you destroy Hamas? And then what? Who takes over? When you go out, what's your exit strategy? Who's going to take over? These are serious questions that we've always faced in all of our previous rounds in Gaza, and will face us also in a future round. But I don't think Israel is willing to continue to accept a situation where every few months we have hundreds of rockets on our cities. Nobody is going to tolerate that for very long.
Even if that operation were to be carried out and it were to be a success, I mean, in terms of what you then do with Gaza and what the sort of things are that need to be done, I mean, they're pretty much, they're similar, aren't they? I mean, in terms of also in the short term, I mean, there are things that can be agreed in terms of opening border crossings, more Palestinian workers from Gaza working in Israel, but long term, you know, building up infrastructure, power. I mean, do you see Are there any sort of clearer plans to be able to do some of this in the future, or is that that's entirely based on Hamas no longer running the Gaza Strip?
The plan is already in place today. There is Israel is part of an effort led by Egypt and the UN envoy to provide the humanitarian economic solution for Gaza. That includes a desalination plant. It includes a new electricity line from Israel because we provide most of their electricity, a water solution, solutions for sewage in Gaza, and also more jobs for Gaza, because the rate of high of unemployment in Gaza is over 50%, and among the youth even over 60%, and that's a catastrophe. Plans are there today, but they are being implemented very, very slowly for lack of funds and for other reasons. And unfortunately, the only external party willing to put money into Gaza is Qatar, just pledged $480 million, most of it to the PA, some of it for Gaza. The plans are there and they are being gradually implemented. And I don't think Israel is the obstacle for that happening. One of the obstacles, the big obstacles, is the Palestinian Authority, because they have provided most of the fund for public services in Gaza. And because of their own political rivalries with Hamas, they started cutting funds to Gaza. Now, being under tremendous economic pressure in the West Bank, they may cut further. And that exacerbates the situation in Gaza. And I suspect that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, would love to see Israel and Hamas at war. They love to drive us towards war. And we, I think, we do not have to play by his tune. It's a very complicated situation. If we find ourselves in another violent round in Gaza, I think it must be followed by a major economic and humanitarian plan to rehabilitate Gaza, but in a way that does not benefit terrorists, but benefits the population.
Just final question on the US plan that could be published after Ramadan in early June. Do you anticipate there'll be a very significant section in that plan on sort of what future things could be done in Gaza to improve the situation there? Or do you think they will sort of try and skirt around it because it's too complicated? What's your assessment?
Well, as I as you mentioned, I'm here in D.C. and I met some people in the administration and also had the opportunity to be present at Jared Kushner's presentation and interview a few days ago. My conclusion is that Gaza is not central in their thinking. They are focused on the plan, on the political horizon. And Gaza, while they're mindful of the challenge of Gaza, it is not a Gaza first plan or something that conditions anything they do regarding their own plan. They are, I think, quite serious in their intention to present the plan sometime next month, after the Jewish holiday of Shavuot. They haven't made the final decision, but the way they talk indicates that they are very serious in their intention to present the plan.
Okay, that sounds like something we'll keep an eye on very closely. Mike, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us. That was really comprehensive. And for our listeners, I just want to say, please go on to iTunes, please review, please comment, and let us know what you thought of today's episode. Thank you, Michael Herzog, very, very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.